Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 05-3174, United States of America versus Venus D. Baldwin, also known as Talisha Johnson, appellant. Mr. Katzoff for the appellant, Ms. Kurt for the appellee.
Good morning. May I please report? Howard Katzoff on behalf of Venus Baldwin. This, as you know, is an appeal from a criminal conviction and sentencing. Appellant raised three issues on appeal. One, that her motion for judgment of acquittal on count 12, the health care fraud count, should have been granted. Two, that the court erroneously applied a four-level sentencing enhancement under Section 3B1.1A of the federal sentencing guidelines. And three, that the court improperly delegated authority to set restitution payment schedule. With regard to the motion for judgment of acquittal on count 12, appellant submits that the government failed to prove or establish sufficient evidence in support of their theory. Even viewing the evidence in a light most favorable to the government, they did not prove that the fraud was in connection with the delivery of or payment for health care benefits, items, and services, or services as alleged. The plain meaning of the in connection with language suggests, when looked at in context, in structure, and the scan history, suggests that that's clearly limiting language, and the court seemed to treat it as very broad language in that in its pretrial ruling indicated that the statute appeared to suggest that the congressional intent was that it should be applied without limitation. Under the rule of lenity, where there is an ambiguity, and so if the court were to consider the in connection with language,
well, what's your definition of in connection with?
My definition is that it has to be in connection with the payment, the delivery of health care benefits, items, or services, generally to an individual, or in connection with the payment for health care benefits, items, or services. Where this case fails,
take the first one, in connection with the delivery of
health care benefits.
So if a company bills a health care provider for something and then doesn't deliver it, it's not covered? That's fraud, isn't it?
Depends on what was billed, as I read the statute.
Whatever, 1,000 needles, whatever.
If they billed 1,000 needles and it wasn't ordered, it wasn't delivered, and it was fraudulent, then that would be in connection with the delivery of items. In this case, it's factually different.
What about dental chairs?
Well, we have argued, and I would submit to the court that the dental chair assembly, under the facts of this case, simply does not mean in connection with the delivery of a health care item. It says, first of all, dental chair assembly.
$7,000 to assemble the chair? That's not a reasonable reading, is it?
$56,000, I believe,
or
something.
To assemble the chair?
It was large. I don't know what it means.
It's a chair. It's not, I don't think it's a reasonable reading to suggest that they were being billed for putting something together. It's a chair. And so how's the chair different than the needles in the hypothetical Judge Randolph gave you?
Assuming it applied to a chair, mm-hmm, as opposed to dental chair assembly, the definitional terms suggest that the statute applies to the delivery of health care items to the patient.
You have to go to another provision of the statute to find that, and that's a bit of a stretch, right? If Congress used that language in another provision of the statute, they could have done so in this, but they didn't. It's broad. I mean, they wanted this to be broad.
Well, I think the simplest way for me to argue that it's ambiguous and that it's limiting is that if you deleted the language completely, then it would read exactly as the judge construed it. And so...
I'm sorry, deleted which language?
The in connection with language.
So if you just said defraud a healthcare provider?
I mean, basically that's what it would be doing. It would largely be repeating what is in the first part of the statute. And that would basically be limitless as the court...
If we agree with you on that reading, you still don't prevail, right? I mean, because we have a connection with the delivery of the dental chairs. If we take the natural reading of the language as a healthcare item, then that doesn't help you much. I mean, we could quarrel with some perhaps broad language in the district court opinion, but on the facts of this case, that doesn't help you a whole lot because you've got the dental chairs.
The testimony in this case was that there were no dental services provided at all by any of these Kaiser Permanente locations, and that really the fair reading of that and the fair reading for a reasonable juror is that there was not the delivery or fraudulent billing for delivery of a real or an actual health care item in that regard, because under the facts and the testimony, it's different than in other cases where, for example, the Hickman case, which actually was in the other direction, the delivery, the fraudulent billing for durable medical equipment, that was equipment that was never prescribed, never ordered for particular patients. But in that regard, that was by a physician billing service that routinely does health care billing for healthcare items. And so in those cases, or those types of cases, it's pretty clear that you have a healthcare item. In this case, where you have testimony that this item is really superfluous in terms of the business that this particular company does, that the fair reading is that that it is not and should not be read to be a healthcare item, and that reasonable jurors should not be able to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that that is a health care item, particularly with the ambiguity of the language of the invoice saying dental chair assembly, which certainly either inference could be drawn, particularly since we really don't know anything about what that means, whether it is some service, whether it is an item. And if it's a service, there's clearly no evidence or testimony that it's a healthcare service, the assembly of a dental chair. So I would submit under the, our facts, it's different than the other cases, and that it still would not satisfy the requirements of proof evidence, viewing the evidence in a light most favorable, that their reasonable jurors couldn't disagree. With regard to the sentencing issue, if I could address that briefly. There's no dispute that this activity involved five or more participants. If it involves five or more participants and you're an organizer or leader, then obviously it's reasonable to assess a four-level increase. In this particular case, I submit the facts are more clear and more along the lines of Quigley, for that she was mid-level and recruited joint venturers who were willing to allow their bank accounts to be used to process checks. And there are a number of factors that seem to suggest that, consistent with the notes, particularly in comparison to the role and the nature of the participation of Beard. And that is the flow of money and the share of the proceeds largely went to Beard. Beard's participation was at the top level, meaning he started the process. He had the insider at Kaiser. Ms. Baldwin didn't have the insider at Kaiser. He recruited Ms. Baldwin and her company to be the conduits for the checks. He is the one that got the fake invoices. He's the one that directed how to do that. Ms. Baldwin didn't do those things. She had a very simple role in the middle, although she recruited people, although she was very active. I submit not much different than Quigley's involvement in 42.
She did recruit people. She was very active. She was essential to the scheme. So aren't you just talking about an interpretation of evidence rather than a sufficiency of evidence? So.
Well, I think I'm talking about both in the sense that the only fair reading of that sets her at a mid-level without control of the type of control that's generally necessary to make a finding of organizer and leader. That really was reserved for Beard in terms of the facts here. And I think that it was a little bit misleading the way the evidence played, because the only informants or insiders who testified were the people close to her, which gave the appearance that she was directing, when really the clear import of the evidence is that Beard came, befriended them, got them to be the conduits, the money flowed to him, and those kind of factors are the ones that established that hierarchy. And I would submit that the court erred in applying the four-level increase.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. Suzanne Kurt on behalf of the United States. I would address the health care item issue first. It is our position, as we stated in our brief, that in the plain reading of the statute shows that the evidence was sufficient in this case based on the fact that the conspirators billed for, and including Ms. Baldwin, dental chair assemblies. Taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, as Judge Griffith has stated, it's clear that these were billing for a health care item. That is,
if it was assembly, would that make a difference?
We don't think it was. It would make a difference because
Why?
Between we think that's a service in putting a health care item together. But I would point out that even
How far does that go? What about the other invoices? Like what about the invoices for the computers? If they could show the computers are used to help diagnostic tests.
As we stated in a footnote in our brief, we think that there is a reasonable argument to be made here that the types of items that Ms. Baldwin purported to bill for in the other invoices are used to help Kaiser in its capacity as a healthcare provider. It's pretty clear that Kaiser cannot operate as a healthcare provider. That's the only function they do without computer services, without environmental services.
Covered?
I'm sorry, you're
right. Healthcare items then, the computers?
We think that those are those could be construed to be in connection with. But of course, the court doesn't need to reach that in this case.
No,
because
but I'm just trying to understand the statute to get the sense of the statute. So what would be a limit to it? What would be some?
Your Honor, we think that there certainly would be circumstances where even though a health care provider was defrauded, it wouldn't necessarily be in connection with health care benefit items.
Give us one.
Yes. Well, one thing we were thinking about, I have a couple of examples. Say Kaiser or any other type of health care provider had its employees' benefits in a 401k program over which, you know, they were overseeing, and there was an investment bank in charge of that 401k program that defrauded Kaiser. Even though a healthcare benefit was defrauded of items, that probably would be a stretch to say that would be in connection with healthcare benefits. Another thing that I thought about later yesterday was, say for example, Kaiser was putting on some kind of charity program as a public outreach benefit, a golf tournament, a picnic for the community, and it was defrauded by the provider who was putting that on or contractor on behalf of Kaiser. Clearly that probably wouldn't be in relation to healthcare benefits. But the testimony from the managers in this particular case, who talked about the other invoices, talked about how their budgets and where they paid these invoices out of were essential to Kaiser's functioning in paying bills, in paying insurers, and in providing environmental services for their medical facilities.
How do you respond to counsel's argument that there's no evidence that Kaiser gave provided any dental services in this part of the country?
I think that testimony, I know that testimony was limited to this particular region and not the entire country. And as we've stated in our brief, I it's clear that on the plain meaning of the statute, a healthcare fraud provider was defrauded in connection with a healthcare benefit item. The fact that Kaiser was not astute enough to discover these before they were paid, I don't think is relevant to the court's inquiry. It was still defrauded of its monies, even though it may not have ordered or purchased a dental chair assembly directly. It was defrauded by a defendant of money in relation to a healthcare benefit item, that is a dental chair assembly.
Yeah, well, there's a functional argument here too, mm-hmm. and that is that first of all, we're talking about a fiction, and there's no such thing as a dental chair or a dental chair. That's the nature of the fraud, mm-hmm. right?
That's
so,
right.
So no matter what, and the same would be true if a doctor billed for all kinds of tests and wound up having performed none of them. You wouldn't say that it wasn't in connection with healthcare services because he didn't do anything. I mean, that's the nature of the fraud. But there is a lulling aspect to this, in that if you're dealing with a healthcare provider and you put on the face of the phony invoice something that deals, that obviously involves healthcare, that it lulls the recipient into thinking that, in fact, services or items were provided. So to the extent that you have dental chair assembly, there is a lulling aspect to that promotes the fraud, whereas computers doesn't necessarily leap out that way.
That's correct, Your Honor. And, in fact, Ms. Baldwin's counsel recognized that during the motions hearing, he was discussing when we were talking about our narrower argument about the three dental chair assemblies. He himself recognized that it was likely that one of the whoever prepared that false invoice realized that if we make it a dental chair assembly, it's all the more likely that it's going to pass inspection in the billing department and get paid that way. Mm-hmm. And even Baldwin's counsel at trial recognized that was probably what was going on in the mind of the person who prepared that particular invoice.
I have to say, I don't see any problem with that word assembly. I did not read that in the sense of being an act of assembling. I read that as meaning that this unit out there that has a chair and a lot of other things hooked to it is an assembly. A dental chair assembly is the object for which they're billing.
And that's how the parties treated
it
below.
Yeah, that's how the parties seem to have treated it.
That's right. And it makes no difference to Kaiser, the victim of the fraud, whether it's what they're being billed for is real or fraudulent or not. They're still losing money regardless. And unless the court has further questions in that regard, I did want to note that I did think that Judge Friedman's opinion was dealing with just the dental chair assemblies alone. So his reading of the statute was not unduly expansive. I think it was limited to the dental chairs. In terms of the role in the offense, of course, the question for the court at this point in time is whether Judge Friedman's findings were clearly erroneous. And we think on the facts of this case, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that she was an organizer in this particular case. Even though Mr. Beard may have had the means by which to start this up, Ms. Baldwin clearly took the ball and ran with it to a very aggressive degree. She used her company for, I believe it was at least 14 of the invoices. She recruited at least three people. She had two of those people create three false companies. She arranged the trip to Florida for the check cashing spree. She bought the tickets on the airline. She directed all the deposits. She played a major role in the money laundering. And even though at the point in time that the fraud was discovered, a large portion of the money may have been in Mr. Beard's coffers, we know based on the records that were found at her home that Ms. Baldwin seemed to play a significant role in distributing the proceeds of the fraud. So unless there's further questions in that particular regard or with respect to the restitution on the third issue raised by Ms. Baldwin, we would submit on our brief. And
on that restitution issue, I take it the government is conceding that there is error in the sentencing?
Yes, based on the Braxton Brown Smith opinion and the two cases that were cited in Braxton Brown Smith, we've conceded on that basis.
Which one was the Seventh Circuit case?
I'm sorry. Oh, Your Honor, the Pandiello case is the Seventh Circuit case. The Johnson was the Fourth Circuit case.
Okay. The Seventh Circuit case was reversed?
I don't know. I checked all those. We checked those, Your Honor, today. I didn't see that. But if that were true, still the Johnson, as the court saying, it was reversed after the Braxton Brown Smith opinion.
I may have my dates wrong.
Okay. But in any event, the Johnson case, Your Honor, embodies the principles that Article III does not permit the delegation to either probation department or the BOP for that particular function of determining how much restitution should be paid.
Yeah, the Braxton Brown case was overruled by the Seventh Circuit this year in United States versus Sawyer.
In the United States versus
Braxton Brown
Sawyer
case.
Pandiello was.
Well, Braxton
Brown is our case.
Yeah, Pandiello.
Pandiello, right.
But Braxton Brown relied upon.
And but so as well as Johnson from the Fourth Circuit, which more extensively discusses. Yeah.
We don't have to accept your confession of error.
No. But I think the court is bound by.
I know in my day, and I realize a lot of things have changed since then, we generally ordered that the schedule for restitution would be determined by the probation office. I know a lot of things have changed since I was a district judge and a defense attorney and a prosecutor, but that was the norm. That was the standard sentence in the red books in those days.
I know that, Your Honor. I was actually surprised to find that when I was reading Braxton Brown Smith and the cases there that the extent to which the delegation is improper, I was because I remember having many sentences myself where the judges just delegated it to probation, and there was never any question raised about that. I think that's somewhat of a more recent development. But in any event, we'd ask the court to affirm. And I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, counsel. You had used up your time. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Getzoff.
That's gracious, Your Honor. I wasn't expecting it, and I will. I'll be brief. If I can start first with the
you
last.
You don't have to take it.
the Seventh Circuit Sawyer decision is still a minority decision. Virtually every other circuit that's addressed it has.
How many others have addressed it?
Virtually every. Well, as to probation, it's there's two issues here: is delegation as to probation and delegation as to the Bureau of Prisons.
Right.
As to probation, no jurisdiction, I don't believe, has ruled that it can be delegated, and that error persists here under any theory. I think otherwise.
Judge Easterbrook said there were six circuits reaching a contrary conclusion. Two, 3, 6, 8, 9, and 10.
That's correct. The 11th Circuit, I think, no, the 9th Circuit, 11th Circuit, I think, was a probation case, but I think six other circuits have addressed the BOP and found the same as Braxton Brown Smith and the 4th Circuit with regard to that. With that, I would rest on the pleadings with regard to the issues at hand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Getzoff, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and the court thanks you for your assistance.